Hello, patrons, and welcome back to H.P. Lovecraft's The Colour Out of Space. At the end of this week, I'll be releasing episode 2 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. But this little classic fiction bonus is, well, it's a little classic fiction bonus, isn't it? Yes. Anyway, last time you may recall that Amy went out to Nahum Gardner's house to find that the house and its grounds had all been consumed by the weird colour from out of space and basically gone to weird hell. Mrs. Gardner was just a moving, crumbling thing in the attic, and very soon Nahum was in a similar state. When Amy left the house, both the gardeners were at peace, and we left him legging it from the farm as fast as he could, because whatever had caused that mysterious splash in the well wasn't any dislodged stone, which can only mean, well, something else, or someone else, must have gone down there. The Colour Out of Space by H.P. Lovecraft. Read by Mike Bennett. Episode 4. When Amy reached his house, the horses and buggy had arrived before him and thrown his wife into fits of anxiety. Reassuring her without explanations, he set out at once for Arkham and notified the authorities that the Gardner family was no more. He indulged in no details, but merely told of the deaths of Nahum and Nabby, that of Thaddeus being already known, and mentioned that the cause seemed to be the same strange ailment which had killed the livestock. He also stated that Merwin and Zenas had disappeared. There was considerable questioning at the police station, and in the end Amy was compelled to take 3 officers to the Gardner farm, together with the coroner, the medical examiner, and the veterinary who had treated the diseased animals. He went much against his will, for the afternoon was advancing, and he feared the fall of night over that accursed place, but it was some comfort to have so many people with him. The 6 men drove out in a Democrat wagon, following Amy's buggy, and arrived at the pest-ridden farmhouse about 4 o'clock. Used as the officers were to gruesome experiences, not one remained unmoved at what was found in the attic and under the red-checked tablecloth on the floor below. The whole aspect of the farm, with its grey desolation, was terrible enough, but those 2 crumbling objects were beyond all bounds. No one could look long at them, and even the medical examiner admitted that there was very little to examine. Specimens could be analysed, of course, so he busied himself in obtaining them, and here it develops that a very puzzling aftermath occurred at the college laboratory, where the 2 files of dust were finally taken. Under the spectroscope, both samples gave off an unknown spectrum, in which many of the baffling bands were precisely like those which the strange meteor had yielded in the previous year. The property of emitting this spectrum vanished in a month, the dust thereafter consisting mainly of alkaline phosphates and carbonates. Amy would not have told the men about the well if he had thought they meant to do anything then and there. It was getting towards sunset, and he was anxious to be away. But he could not help glancing nervously at the stony curb by the great sweep, and when a detective questioned him, he admitted that Nahum had feared something down there, so much so that he had never even thought of searching it for Merwin or Zenas. After that, nothing would do but that they empty and explore the well immediately. So Amy had to wait, trembling, while pail after pail of rank water was hauled up and splashed on the soaking ground outside. The men sniffed in disgust at the fluid, and toward the last held their noses against the fetor they were uncovering. It was not so long a job as they had feared it would be, since the water was phenomenally low. There is no need to speak too exactly of what they found. Merwin and Zenas were both there, in part, though the vestiges were mainly skeletal. There were also a small deer and a large dog in about the same state, and a number of bones of small animals. The ooze and slime at the bottom seemed inexplicably porous and bubbling, and a man who descended on handholds with a long pole found that he could sink the wooden shaft to any depth in the mud of the floor without meeting any solid obstruction. Twilight had now fallen, and lanterns were brought from the house. Then, when it was seen that nothing further could be gained from the well, everyone went indoors and conferred in the ancient sitting-room, while the intermittent light of a spectral half-moon played wanly on the grey desolation outside. The men were frankly nonplussed by the entire case, and could find no convincing common element to link the strange vegetable conditions, the unknown disease of livestock and humans, and the unaccountable deaths of Merwin and Zenas in the tainted well. They had heard the common country talk, it is true, but could not believe that anything contrary to natural law had occurred. No doubt the meteor had poisoned the soil, but the illness of persons and animals who had eaten nothing grown in that soil was another matter. Was it the well water? Very possibly. It might be a good idea to analyse it, but what peculiar madness could have made both boys jump into the well? Their deeds were so similar, and the fragments showed that they had both suffered from the grey, brittle death. Why was everything so grey and brittle? It was the coroner, seated near a window overlooking the yard, who first noticed the glow about the well. Night had fully set in, and all the abhorrent ground seemed faintly luminous with more than the fitful moonbeams. But this new glow was something definite and distinct, and appeared to shoot up from the black pit like a softened ray from a searchlight, giving dull reflections in the little ground pools where the water had been emptied. It had a very queer colour, and as all the men clustered round the window, Amy gave a violent start. For this strange beam of ghastly miasma was to him of no unfamiliar hue. He had seen that colour before, and feared to think what it might mean. He had seen it in the nasty, brittle globule in that aerolite 2 summers ago, had seen it in the crazy vegetation of the springtime, and had thought he had seen it for an instant that very morning against the small barred window of that terrible attic room where the nameless things had happened. It had flashed there for a second, and a clammy and hateful current of vapour had brushed past him. And then poor Nahum had been taken by something of that colour. He had said so at the last, said it was like the globule and the plants. After that had come the runaway in the yard and the splash in the well, and now that well was belching forth to the night a pale, insidious beam of the same demoniac tint. It does credit to the alertness of Amy's mind that he puzzled, even at that tense moment, over a point which was essentially scientific. He could not but wonder at his gleaning of the same impression from a vapour glimpsed in the daytime against a window opening on the morning sky, and from a nocturnal exhalation seen as a phosphorescent mist against the black and blasted landscape. It wasn't right. It was against nature. And he thought of those terrible last words of his stricken friend. "It come from a place where things ain't as they is here. One of them professors said so." All three horses outside, tied to a pair of shriveled saplings by the road, were now neighing and pawing frantically. The wagon driver started for the door to do something, but Amy laid a shaky hand on his shoulder.
"Don't go out thar," he whispered. "There's more to this nor what we know. Nahum said something lived in the well that sucks your life out. He said it must be summat growed from a round ball like one we all seen in the meteor stone that fell a year ago June. "Sucks and burns," he said, "and it's just a cloud of colour like that light out there now that you can hardly see and can't tell what it is. Nahum thought it feeds on everything living and gets stronger all the time. He said he seen it this last week. It must be something from away off in the sky, like the men from the college last year says the meteor stone was. The way it's made and the way it works ain't like no way of God's world. It's summit from beyond."
So the men paused indecisively as the light from the well grew stronger and the hitched horses pawed and whinnied in an increasing frenzy. It was truly an awful moment, with terror in that ancient and accursed house itself. Four monstrous sets of fragments, two from the house and two from the well in the woodshed behind, and that shaft of unknown and unholy iridescence from the slimy depths in front. Amy had restrained the driver on impulse, forgetting how uninjured he himself was after the clammy brushing of that coloured vapour in the attic room. But perhaps it was just as well that he acted as he did. No one will ever know what was abroad that night, and though the blasphemy from beyond had not so far hurt any human of unweakened mind, there is no telling what it might not have done at that last moment, with its seemingly increased strength and the special signs of purpose it was soon to display beneath the half-clouded, moonlit sky. All at once, one of the detectives at the window gave a short, sharp gasp. The others looked at him, and then quickly followed his gaze upward to the point at which its idle straying had suddenly arrested. There was no need for words. What had been disputed in country gossip was disputable no longer, and it is because of the thing which every man of that party agreed in whispering later on that the strange days are never talked about in Arkham. It is necessary to premise that there was no wind at that hour of the evening. One did arise not long afterward, but there was absolutely none then. Even the dry tips of the lingering hedge mustard, grey and blighted, and the fringe on the roof of the standing Democrat wagon were unstirred. And yet, amid that tense, godless calm, the high, bare boughs of all the trees in the yard were moving. They were twitching morbidly and spasmodically, clawing in convulsive and epileptic madness at the moonlit clouds, scratching impotently in the noxious air, as if jerked by some allied and bodiless line of linkage, with subterranean writhing and struggling below the black roots. Not a man breathed for several seconds. Then a cloud of darker depth passed over the moon, and the silhouette of clutching branches faded out momentarily. At this, there was a general cry, muffled with awe, but husky and almost identical from every throat, for the terror had not faded with the silhouette, and in a fearsome instant of deeper darkness, the watchers saw, wriggling at that treetop height, a thousand tiny points of faint and unhallowed radiance, tipping each bough like the fire of St. Elmo, or the flames that come down on the apostles' heads at Pentecost. It was a monstrous constellation of unnatural light, like a glutted swarm of corpse-fed fireflies dancing hellish sarabands over an accursed marsh, and its colour was that same nameless intrusion which Amy had come to recognise and dread. All the while, the shaft of phosphorescence from the well was getting brighter and brighter, bringing to the minds of the huddled men a sense of doom and abnormality. It was no longer shining out. It was pouring out. And as the shapeless stream of unplaceable colour left the well, it seemed to flow directly into the sky. The veterinary shivered and walked to the front door to drop the heavy extra bar across it. Amy shook no less, and had to tug and point for lack of controllable voice when he wished to draw notice to the growing luminosity of the trees. The neighing and stamping of the horses had become utterly frightful, but not a soul of that group in the old house would have ventured forth for any earthly reward. With the moments, the shining of the trees increased, while their restless branches seemed to strain more and more toward verticality. The wood of the well sweep was shining now, and presently a policeman dumbly pointed to some wooden sheds and beehives near the stone wall on the west. They were commencing to shine too, though the tethered vehicles of the visitors seemed so far unaffected. Then there was a wild commotion and clopping in the road, and as Amy quenched the lamp for better seeing, they realized that the span of frantic greys had broken their sapling and run off with a Democrat wagon. The shock served to loosen several tongues, and embarrassed whispers were exchanged.
"It spreads on everything organic that's been around here,"
muttered the medical examiner. No one replied, but the man who had been in the well gave a hint that his long pole must have stirred up something intangible.
"It was awful," he added. "There was no bottom at all, just ooze and bubbles and the feeling of something lurking under there."
Amy's horse still pawed and screamed deafeningly in the road outside, and nearly drowned its owner's faint quaver as he mumbled his formless reflections.
"It come from that stone. It growed down thar. It got everything living. It fed itself on 'em, mind and body. Tad and Merwin, Zenas and Nabby, Nahum was the last. They all drunk the water. It got strong on 'em. It come from beyond. What, things ain't like they be here. Now it's going home."
At this point, as the column of unknown colour flared suddenly stronger and stronger and began to weave itself into fantastic suggestions of shape, which each spectator later described differently, there came from poor tethered Hero such a sound as no man before or since ever heard from a horse. Every person in that low-pitched sitting room stopped his ears, and Amy turned away from the window in horror and nausea. Words could not convey it. When Amy looked again, the hapless beast lay huddled inert on the moonlit ground between the splintered shafts of the buggy. That was the last of Hero till they buried him the next day. But the present was no time to mourn, for almost at this instant a detective silently called attention to something terrible in the very room with them. In the absence of the lamplight, it was clear that a faint phosphorescence had begun to pervade the entire apartment. It glowed on the broad planked floor and the fragment of rag carpet, and shimmered over the sashes of the small paned windows. It ran up and down the exposed corner posts, coruscated about the shelf and mantel, and infected the very doors and furniture. Each minute saw it strengthen, and at last it was very plain that healthy, living things must leave that house. Amy showed them the back door and the path up through the fields to the 10-acre pasture. They walked and stumbled as in a dream, and did not dare look back till they were far away on the high ground. They were glad of the path, for they could not have gone the front way by that well. It was bad enough passing the glowing barn and sheds and those shining orchard trees with their gnarled, fiendish contours, but thank heaven the branches did their worst twisting high up. The moon went under some very black clouds as they crossed the rustic bridge over Chapman's Brook, and it was blind groping from there to the opened meadows. When they looked back toward the valley and the distant gardener place at the bottom, they saw a fearsome sight. All the farm was shining with the hideous unknown blend of colour. Trees, buildings, and even such grass and herbage as had not been wholly changed to lethal grey brittleness. The boughs were all straining skyward, tipped with tongues of foul flame, and lambent tricklings of the same monstrous fire were creeping about the ridgepoles of the house, barn, and sheds. It was a scene from a vision of Fuseli, and over all the rest reigned that riot of luminous amorphousness, that alien and undimensioned rainbow of cryptic poison from the well, seething, feeling, lapping, reaching, scintillating, straining and malignly bubbling in its cosmic and unrecognizable chromaticism. Then, without warning, the hideous thing shot vertically up toward the sky like a rocket or meteor, leaving behind no trail, and disappearing through a round and curiously regular hole in the clouds before any man could gasp or cry out. No watcher can ever forget that sight, and Ami stared blankly at the stars of Cygnus, Deneb twinkling above the others, where the unknown colour had melted into the Milky Way. But his gaze was the next moment called swiftly to earth by the crackling in the valley. It was just that, only a wooden ripping and crackling, and not an explosion as so many others of the party vowed. Yet the outcome was the same, for in one feverish kaleidoscopic instant there burst up from that doomed and accursed farm a gleaming, eruptive cataclysm of unnatural sparks and substance, blurring the glance of the few who saw it, and sending forth to the zenith a bombarding cloudburst of such coloured and fantastic fragments as our universe must needs disown. Through quickly reclosing vapours, they followed the great morbidity that had vanished, and in another second they had vanished too. Behind and below was only a darkness to which the men dared not return, and all about was a mounting wind which seemed to sweep down in black, frore gusts from interstellar space. It shrieked and howled and lashed the fields and distorted woods in a mad cosmic frenzy, till soon the trembling party realized it would be no use waiting for the moon to show what was left down there at Nahum's. Too awed even to hint theories, the seven shaking men trudged back toward Arkham by the north road. Ami was worse than his fellows, and begged them to see him inside his own kitchen instead of keeping straight on to town. He did not wish to cross the blighted, wind-whipped woods alone to his home on the main road, for he had had an added shock that the others were spared, and was crushed for ever with a brooding fear he dared not even mention for many years to come. As the rest of the watchers on that tempestuous hill had stolidly set their faces toward the road, Ami had looked back in an instant at that shadowed valley of desolation, so lately sheltering his ill-starred friend, and from that stricken, faraway spot he had seen something feebly rise, only to sink down again upon the place from which the great shapeless horror had shot into the sky. It was just a colour, but not any colour of our earth or heavens. And because Ami recognised that colour, and knew that this last faint remnant must still lurk down there in the well, he has never been quite right since. Ami could never go near the place again. It is 44 years now since the horror happened, but he has never been there, and will be glad when the new reservoir blots it out. I shall be glad too, for I do not like the way the sunlight changed colour around the mouth of that abandoned well I passed. I hope the water will always be very deep, but even so I shall never drink it. I do not think I shall visit the Arkham country hereafter. Three of the men who had been with Ami returned the next morning to see the ruins by daylight, but there were not any real ruins, only the bricks of the chimney, the stones of the cellar, some mineral and metallic litter here and there, and the rim of that nefandous well. Save for Ami's dead horse, which they towed away and buried, and the buggy which they shortly returned to him, Everything that had ever been living there had gone. 5 eldritch acres of dusty grey desert remained, nor has anything ever grown there since. To this day it sprawls open to the sky like a great spot eaten by acid in the woods and fields, and the few who have ever dared glimpse it in spite of the rural tales have named it the Blasted Heath. The rural tales are queer. They might even be queerer if city men and college chemists could be interested enough to analyse the water from that disused well, or the grey dust that no wind seems to disperse. Botanists, too, ought to study the stunted flora on the borders of that spot, for they might shed light on the country notion that the blight is spreading, little by little, perhaps an inch a year. People say the colour of the neighbouring herbage is not quite right in the spring, and that wild things leave queer prints in the light winter snow. Snow never seems quite so heavy on the Blasted Heath as it is elsewhere. Horses, the few that are left in this motor age, grow skittish in the silent valley, and the hunters cannot depend on their dogs too near the splotch of greyish dust. They say the mental influences are very bad too. Numbers went queer in the years after Nahum's taking, and always they lacked the power to get away. Then the stronger-minded folk all left the region, and only the foreigners tried to live in the crumbling old homesteads. They could not stay, though, and one sometimes wonders what insight beyond ours their wild, weird stories of whispered magic have given them. Their dreams at night, they protest, are very horrible in that grotesque country, and surely the very look of the dark realm is enough to stir a morbid fancy. No traveller has ever escaped a sense of strangeness in those deep ravines, and artists shiver as they paint thick woods whose mystery is as much of the spirit as of the eye. I myself am curious about the sensation I derived from my one lone walk before Ami told me his tale. When twilight came, I had vaguely wished some clouds would gather, for an odd timidity about the deep, skyey voids above had crept into my soul. Do not ask me for my opinion. I do not know. That is all. There was no one but Ami to question, for Arkham people will not talk about the strange days, and all three professors who saw the aerolite and its coloured globule are dead. There were other globules, depend on that. One must have fed itself and escaped, and probably there was another which was too late. No doubt it is still down the well. I know there was something wrong with the sunlight I saw above the miasmal brink. The rustics say the blight creeps an inch a year, so perhaps there is a kind of growth or nourishment even now. But whatever demon hatching is there, it must be tethered to something, or else it would quickly spread. Is it fastened to the roots of those trees that claw the air? One of the current Arkham tales is about fat oaks that shine and move as they ought not to do at night. What it is, only God knows. In terms of matter, I suppose the things Ami described would be called a gas, but this gas obeyed the laws that are not of our cosmos. This was no fruit of such worlds and suns as shine on the telescopes and photographic plates of our observatories. This was no breath from the skies whose motions and dimensions our astronomers measure or deem too vast to measure. It was just a colour out of space, a frightful messenger from unformed realms of infinity beyond all nature as we know it, from realms whose mere existence stuns the brain and numbs us with the black, extra-cosmic gulfs it throws open before our frenzied eyes. I doubt very much if Ami consciously lied to me, and I do not think his tale was all a freak of madness as the townsfolk had forewarned. Something terrible came to the hills and valleys on that meteor, and something terrible, though I know not in what proportion, still remains. I shall be glad to see the water come. Meanwhile, I hope nothing will happen to Ami. He saw so much of the thing, and its influence was so insidious. Why has he never been able to move away? How clearly he recalled those dying words of Nahum's.
Can't get away. Draws ye. You know summat's comin', but 'tain't no use.
Ami is such a good old man. When the reservoir gang gets to work, I must write the chief engineer to keep a sharp watch on him. I would hate to think of him as the grey, twisted, brittle monstrosity which persists more and more in troubling my sleep. Thank you for listening to H.P. Lovecraft's The Colour Out of Space. Music on the podcast came from Andrew Rothman. This podcast has been brought to you today by you. Yes, you, and all my other sponsors at Patreon. Thank you for supporting me, and never forget that everything I produce from now on, be it on paper or on podcast, is as a result of your contribution. I did a mini fist pump there, but obviously you couldn't see it.